WDB 860 AM Philadelphia and WPEN HD2 Burlington, Philadelphia.
The following programming is sponsored by
MBC Media.
The views expressed do not necessarily reflect this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And the eagle will fly.
And welcome back to the conservative voice on WWDB AM 860 in Philadelphia. Glad to have you with us this afternoon. We're going to kick off this next hour, starting off with Darren Gobb, who's been with us before. Just a great resource for us on all matters of geopolitical importance. But if you would like to join the conversation at any point, if you have a question for us, feel free to dial in. The number is 888-329-3306, 888-329-3306. Again, thanks for listening to us this afternoon. Darren, welcome back to the Conservative Voice. It's nice to have you with us again.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. And once again, greetings from Western Montana, where it was 36 degrees overnight.
Oh, it was. Oh, nice.
So you're close to snow up there. We'll come visit you.
We've already seen it up in the mountains. So we're happy snowmobiles are getting warmed up.
And,
we're waiting.
All right, listen, one of these Fridays, we're going to fly to you and the show from there, okay?
Yeah, that's the play. I love the winter, and I love to play in the winter. I mean, it's just, there's nothing better than a 25-degree day with sun in the sky, snow on the ground, walking through a forest.
Mm.
It's about as good as life gets, especially if you've got a good dog with you. Maybe some people, I don't know.
I mean, I prefer animal company myself.
And I would argue it may be a couple firearms because we do have grizzlies and stuff.
Yeah, well, there's always that. You got to be prepared for everything. When they say stay frosty, that's easier at 25 degrees than it is at 85.
Yeah.
So, I'll tell you what, I saw a video real quick. I saw a video out of, it was either Tennessee or North Carolina. It was right before the storm, really, the flooding picked up. And it was a man outside of his front door. And he said, boy, those are some big squirrels. He had a family of four or five large black bears in a tree higher than his house. And I said, man, someone should have taken that as a warning and gotten out of there. Like, you see black bears higher than your house in a tree. Something's going on.
Yeah.
Something they know something you're not quite aware of yet.
They're scoping out the scene there.
They're
casing the joint.
Yeah.
Well, you know... We were talking in the first hour of the show today, Ada and I and our guest, about the October surprises, which are many, it seems.
They'll be never ending, I think.
I think each day is going to bring a new surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that has been, of course, troubling to everyone is this situation between Iran and Israel, which, you know, obviously could end up becoming a much bigger, much bigger conflict. The risk of escalation and expansion in both Ukraine and in the Middle East now seems to me to be heightened. But, we wanted to get your thoughts on this. We all talked with you a couple of weeks ago about how we were expecting, and Americans were sitting on the edge of their seats wondering when Iran was going to attack again. And now you look at what Israel has done with Hezbollah and Hamas, their agents in Israel,
which they usually work through proxies, right? They use Hamas and Hezbollah to carry out their attacks on Israel. However, this week we saw them take direct action.
Right. So we saw the big attack, and we saw the list of the leadership of Hezbollah who have been eliminated systematically in a very short period of time.
Not a very good job to be in line for, I don't think, leadership of Hezbollah. I think, like, maybe not this time, guys, next time.
Their recruiters are going to have maybe some struggling. There'll be some convincing here.
Yeah.
But
listen, you're going to take over leadership, but we also need you to hide in this cave for the next 5 years. Does that sound agreeable to you?
Well, they did already kill his replacement.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's incredible what's happening. And so the question for you is, then, of course, the biggest concern I think most Americans have right now is that we have an inept government, or at least a government that whose motives aren't to serve the American people, as we demonstrated in the first hour. And we've got this thing going on in the Middle East that could really expand and escalate. what do you see as the risk of this getting worse? What do you think? What do you think the situation is on the ground there?
Well, and this is a good concern for people to have, primarily because we do not need as America to get drawn into some sort of land war in Iran or in Central Asia. I mean, if you remember the quote from the Princess Bride, you know, never get into a land war in Asia. That's good advice. And there's no reason for us to do that. But I think what's critical is that people understand more about how the Iranian military works than how our military works, because sometimes we project how we look at a military upon other nations, and they do things differently. Simple way to put it is Iran's military within the nation of Iran is designed mostly for regime security and policing of their population so they don't get out of hand and work against the tiny tyrants of Tehran.
Yeah.
That's their purpose. They're not going to go driving from Iran across Iraq, Jordan, Syria, and into Israel. So their army is, of course, Hamas and Hezbollah, and to some extent, Houthis. But you know, they needed something on the border of Israel to be really effective. In that case, now they're looking at the fact that they've lost Hamas. They're probably going to lose Hezbollah, and they've already lost most of the leadership, and they keep leading it, keep losing it. So what are you really looking at? Is you're looking at an Iran that's on the tipping point of those tiny tyrants losing, and they know it. So they're lashing out. But they're not, and this is the last point I'll make and hand it off, but you're not going to see Iran drive across the desert with large formations of armor and artillery and things like that to go against Israel. Right. They'll lose their own country to their own people when they do that. So what you're going to see is more of the same. Rockets, ballistic missiles, drones, things like that, which if we get 100% behind Israel, help them with logistics, intelligence, and other things like that, then they can handle it just fine. We don't need to get sucked further in. And so there's more I could cover, but I don't want to talk for half an hour straight.
We love having you talk for half an hour straight, but I'm going to point out that I don't think anyone died in the Israel attacks, right, on the Israel side. I don't think there was any loss of life.
I'm not tracking any. I know some people did die. There were some incidentals, I guess you could say, for lack of, I hate to minimize any death regardless, but with that volume of fire, you're going to have something. So there mm-hmm. have been a few, but I think they were not what you would call Israeli citizens.
However, on Iran's side, they had two IRGC troops killed and 12 people injured in their launch of that attack. So they hurt themselves launching that attack on Israel. I don't know if you had heard that.
Yeah. Yeah, if anybody's ever seen the famous little toy rocket that when you shoot it, it comes back right on you like a boomerang, that happens. And it did happen.
So when we are told about the might of Iran, and then we hear that they killed people on their own launch pads accidentally in launching their attack on Israel, it does seem to be two different sides of a story there.
Yeah, we cannot display or focus on our own challenges within our own military and then think that other nations don't have their own problems. I've worked with many Middle Eastern nations, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and many others. Some are more capable than others, but ultimately none of them are still remotely anywhere near as capable as ours, despite the challenges we have with our commander-in-chief and those he's appointed, even in uniform. So what I don't want to do is paint the picture of a U.S. military that is so bad that people should be scared. But given what has happened to our military, they need to make sure we get them a decent commander-in-chief and everybody get behind fixing it. But Iran's military, Iraq, these are just kind of haphazard conglomerates of people put together, and they're willing to the only thing they're good at is slaughter. What they're not good at is strategy and tactics.
Mm-hmm. But you're coming to a point here that's really important, I think, which is that whatever the capability of our military is, and we have all met incredible people that are in the military. We all have family that have been in the military, or many of us do. But no matter how good the military is, the leadership issue can't be ignored.
Well, and you also have the aspect that we have an all-volunteer military.
Mm-hmm.
If the people who are raising the children or the children as they come into adulthood at the age in which they could enlist mm-hmm. do not trust their leaders, what makes them enlist? What makes them join the military? We have a huge shortfall in recruitment in our military right now because they don't trust the leadership and the conflicts that they may get us into. So, yeah, I mean, Darren, you're right. They need a strong leader. We can't rebuild our military without strong leadership. People will not go in.
Well, there's no point in rebuilding a tool if you've got an operator who doesn't know how to use it.
Right.
And our leadership in our government, and it's at the senior ranks of military too. We all remember Milley, you know, leaning forward and talking about he wants to understand white rage.
Oh my gosh.
You know, this guy's as far away from...
Well, that's Joint Chiefs of Staff, so that's a little...
It's still a significant part of our thinking as a nation on how these military and foreign services assets are used. And when it does appear that they use our military for their own political and other agendas, as opposed to in service to the American people, it becomes troubling. And that's what it looks like to me. I wonder what the attitude is inside the military right now.
Well, there's a mix. And, you know, I talk to people all the time, you know, and talk to a lot of folks about whether or not their kids should join the military or not and things like that. So if you dig into the problem, what you're going to come down to is the same thing you've got across multiple agencies, which is there's a lot of good people within the ranks, but the management is terrible. And unfortunately, the longer you leave bad management in place, the more they recruit their own type of thinkers.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, you've got horribly trained IRS agents showing up at gun shops acting like they're a SWAT team who are horribly inept and more dangerous to themselves and the people just because they don't know what they're doing.
Right.
And so the longer we let this go, like if we had, let's just, God forbid, say we had another 8 years of the Kamala Harris mentality of things. Now you've got federal agencies that will reflect more the World War II era Stasis and Gestapos than you will what they're supposed to as, well, frankly, our employees. And the same is true of the military. So we're going to have to, we have to get to this, these solutions now. We do not have time to wait because those good people who really do want to serve this nation in the military and do what the military is supposed to do, those few who are remaining will also opt out and do something else.
Yeah, there's a saying, what was it? You can vote yourself into communism, but you'll have to shoot your way out of it. And I think that, you know, we are either already there. I mean, I think the next 3 months is going to tell us for sure whether we're there yet or not, or we are on the cusp of it. And I remember listening to people talk about communism, Marxism, fascism 8 years ago and thinking they were insane because, I mean, they were directing it all at Trump supporters. And I'm thinking, well, I don't hold any of those values or beliefs. And literally just a short 8 years later, we are seeing actual policies that align far more with that type of government than our own republic that we have spent so many hundreds of years working towards.
Absolutely. My opinion is we're already in kind of like a trial communism phase.
Yeah. It's like communism light.
The frog in the pot getting closer to the top.
It is. I always say, you know, what we're really seeing here is the American system being converted into the Soviet system, right? Where government decides what happens in the economy. Government decides which companies, which people get promoted or hired or fired. I remember when Obama fired the CEO of General Motors and appointed a new one.
Mm-hmm.
And it went really unnoticed in the country, but it was a milestone in a system that was not supposed to be an economy run by the government. But that's what he did. He had an auto czar at the time, Ratner, and they just made this decision to fire the guy and get a new one.
Right. As if that's the government's decision.
Right. That's exactly
it. Sure, that's definitely a free market choice that should be happening and not...
Right. You know, we come back to this, what is the role of government? And it all keeps... It's this sort of cauldron of problems that are created by a government that is resentful of the Constitution, that is resentful of its people, that has no loyalty to its people, as we've seen in South Carolina or North Carolina. And it's It's got disdain for an economy that's free, whether that they don't control, spending money without regard to the implications for inflation and everything else. It's just astonishing what's going on. So, you know, that obviously translates into our geopolitical problems. So 18 months after Trump's out of office, we're having credible discussions about thermonuclear war. Mm. And now we're at this point where the Middle East is on fire. So,
well, don't leave out China and Taiwan, because I'm sure any day now that'll start firing up again.
Right.
I mean, we're looking at multiple conflicts that really were at a low simmer or not even boiling back in 2020, 2021.
Right.
Well, that's the other key lesson I think people need to really wrap their heads around, and it's not an easy thing to do, which is, you know, we cannot look at Russia, Ukraine, Israel at all, and the China piece and other smaller conflicts in a vacuum, each of their own, because they're so intertwined and connected in so many ways that we have to recognize that four-way Russia, Iran, North Korea, China thing is driving much of this. And if we think about what happens if the U.S. gets involved in a conflict where now we're sucked into something against Russia, who, you know, takes advantage of their contacts throughout the Middle East and what they've been doing in Central Asia, and expands what's happening with Israel, and we think we need to now get involved in that. If we think that China's not going to look and say, great, all their resources and assets and focus is there, this is the time for us to do to reunify the people of China on the Isle of Formosa.
Yeah.
And now we're sitting here going, you know, it kind of sucks to be the world police when you've got basically so much crime and no policemen left.
Yes. It's one thing after another. And again, it's not incompetence. There's we were all told for much of our lives, never attribute to nefarious intent that which could be explained by incompetence, which was a great way to make us all just accept whatever these people did and scoff at it and move along.
It's not incompetence.
It is intentional. It is strategy and tactics being implemented by people that seek to transform this nation. So when you look forward and you say, all right, here's where we are. We've got this you know, attack on Israel that didn't achieve what they wanted, or maybe it did, because they got to do this. They got to execute the attack, but not spur a full retaliation from multiple parties. They've obviously failed to create any kind of a consensus among the Muslim world to unify and attack Israel. Unless that's in the works, that obviously has not happened. They wanted to do that before now, I presume. Is that right, or am I assuming something not correct?
No, that's right. The top talking point I wrote down after that Iranian attack was, Iran failed massively again. They just did it louder this time.
So right.
This is why I call Iran's regime near failure or failing, and why they're lashing out like this. Now, their incompetence is on display, and frankly, they're alienating some of the nations in the Middle East and Central Asia, because if they're trying to expand the conflict, well, it's not like Saudi Arabia and Jordan and some other nations around there are interested in having this turn into a massive conflagration that takes, you know, their nations and pulls them in. They don't want to be there either.
Right. And
some of those are, you know, imperfect allies, but they're allies nonetheless, and the proof is in the fact that some of them signed on to things like the Abraham Accords. So why would we assume that Iran is working in the Middle East and Central Asia where everybody's on their side? By the way, they're having conflicts on their borders with Afghanistan. They're walling off things to keep some of the terroristic tendencies inside Afghanistan from trickling over into Iran, too. So they've got their own problems. And what we can do is let them stew in their problems and not create more through our own ineptness. Just kind of let Israel do what it's doing by decapitating leadership all over the place. And I think the mullahs better be looking around every corner.
Yeah, so they've got these internal problems. They're struggling then with pressures from outside. They've launched what they can launch against Israel. They haven't been able to build a coalition. So while I don't want to, I'll never dismiss this or take it lightly, but the risk of an escalation and expansion that means more countries getting involved or the violence rising to a higher level, the risk of both of those, expansion or escalation, seems to be muted right now. Right now, the fight's going to continue, but we may be in a position where the globalists aren't able to drag the American military into it, and the Iranians aren't able to drag the Arab and Muslim nations into it. And so the fight just continues at this level. Am I summarizing it correctly, or am I missing a critical element?
Well, you're summarizing it correctly as it is now. What we hope we don't happen is our ineptness in the White House and the Secretary of Defense's office creates a scenario where we are the problem. Because, I mean, what I see happening right now is best described as kind of like that boxing match where you've got two almost equal fighters.
Uh-huh.
And one of them has this strategy of letting the other fighter exhaust himself, and they're just waiting for that one moment when they come in, land one blow that knocks the whole thing out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Israel is letting Iran exhaust itself of all kinds of things, money, mm-hmm. material, prestige. And I just say, let them keep doing it. Don't fully support Israel and get out of the way.
It's funny. I recently heard someone talking. I mean, funny. I don't know if it's funny, haha, but funny. That it was Trump's fault that Iran was behaving this way because he pulled us out of the bad Iran deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that the Biden administration brought themselves back into the Iran deal. So it was Trump who caused the conflict to escalate in the Middle East. And I find that ridiculous and absurd because we can see two very clear examples that the U.S. government in regards to Russia shut down oil production here and started buying tons of oil from Russia. And when you buy oil from Russia, you give them financial resources they did not previously have. And what they did with those financial resources is carry out their invasion or incursion in Ukraine. And then you have the U.S. government under Joe Biden and Kamala Harris mm-hmm. giving Iran money by rejoining the Iran deal.
Mm-hmm.
And then what does Iran do shortly after? They regain their ability to finance Hezbollah and Hamas and all of these other groups and to carry out their terrorism in the region that they're in and they want control over. So we've watched two very specific examples of Biden-Harris financing that country using the money that is American money to then carry out their wars. So there's no denying that the Biden-Harris administration is responsible for the escalation that we've seen around the world. And I think that it is imperative for Americans to really understand that these conflicts were not boiling over the way that they are 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And with any luck and maybe some grace, that will stay largely the same, I guess you could say. I mean, it's already here. So let's try to temper it and make sure that we aren't the problem that lights the larger fire. And right. Unfortunately, you can't say that with confidence right now these days. So,
well, you can't. So, but it's interesting. What you're introducing into this is that the big risk, one of the major risks, is the incompetence or the personal goals or the personal interest of the people that have control of our military and foreign service. You know, that mixture mm-hmm. of incompetence, which is clear, and that mixture of this globalist mindset that pushes them to want more wars and want to be conquering and doing things. You know, that's one of the major risks we face. And of course, the only way to fix that is to make a decision on November 5 to change these people out. We can't, the world can't, no one can sustain 4 more years of this kind of lunacy in the United States.
We can't. And that's why it's not just this Trump-Harris issue. And that's a big part of it. But when you look down ballot, let's start with the Senate and why the Senate is actually the crown jewel in this particular election cycle.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who confirm agency leads. They're the ones who confirm a lot of different things and to include international or other kinds of treaties. And so if the Senate's going to stay in the hands of the Democrats, which are in the globalists, regardless of party, what you're going to find is a Senate that's willing to sign off on the pandemic treaty under the World Health Organization and all kinds of things like that. So we have to make sure that the supporting cast, I guess you could say, up and down ballot, gets a complete overhaul. Because what we have now is completely unsustainable in a free republic and definitely mirrors more Russia, Soviet Union, 1970s and and forward.
Charlie Wilson's war.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Darren, I want to, if we can just switch gears for a moment here. On your Substack, on your Substack, I guess you've got two Substack channels. And one is Vincit Veritas by Darren Gobb. And in there you have the lessons of the lesson of Lahaina, Hawaii, and Hurricane Helene. And you started out talking about something we touched on in the first hour, which is this issue of having a muted or ineffective response by government and having people that are over there trying to help rescue folks get pushed away. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've heard? Because I know you've been in touch with people on the front lines in North Carolina, or at least I think. Is that right?
Yes, North Carolina, Tennessee, Ohio, Kentucky. Talked to some folks I'm working with in South Carolina, too, because they've had some significant damage there as well.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately, as we step back from this, there's a lot of people that are in the daily fight right now that are grinding away, that are working hard. And we have to leave them alone and let them do what they're doing most excellently. And we're involved in that in our own minor way as well. But I thought it was important to get out the message that not only Lahaina, Hawaii, but this hurricane devastation. And frankly, let's just go to Katrina, and people can pick a variety of different things that have happened. But what it has shown is that that incompetence within our federal government and often within some of our state governments, to include Tennessee, has bled over into the either lack of desire, the willful desire, or general incompetence to be able to respond to emergencies, where the citizen army, as I call it, is showing how it's done. And that's absolutely essential. It has to continue forward. That's why we started the County Guardian program with Restore Liberty, and we're going to get as many counties on board across the nation as we can, because we need to know who we can trust. We need to be able to share information among people we can trust very quickly in these environments and be able to say, you probably shouldn't give your money to any government agency. Well, you're already doing that. And you might even want to be careful about giving it to something like a Red Cross.
Yeah.
I'm not saying don't. I'm just saying I go with organizations I can trust and the people I trust, and then I can push those organizations and the names and stuff out there for the greater good, not for any other motive.
And right. Darren, if you could do me a favor and send me or tag the Conservative Voice in a post of some organizations that you know are working down there, I'll also share some on TC Voice, WWDB on Twitter. So that way anyone listening in our local area who wants to help can click on those links and donate some money or resources.
Absolutely. And that even includes my organization, because if you donate to our C4 nonprofit side of the house, we're going to purchase some water purification systems that can do up to 1,000 gallons a day. So
amazing. They definitely need that.
And I'll also advertise someone on Twitter. Her handle is Margo in WNC, which stands for Western North Carolina, but that's Margo in WNC. And she's got a bunch of information about a variety of things going on down there, and she lives there, and that would be one great resource. But I do have something she shared with me that I'll give with you as well.
All right, I'll be sure to share her profile on our page also. Yeah, what we've seen out of there this week has been nothing short of shocking and apocalyptic, some of the videos I'm seeing out of the mountains. And it is truly stunning that we're a week in now and people are still without water and food and have not seen a rescue person or personnel to come help them, 7 days later. So they definitely need all the resources they can get. I know that, they're asking volunteers to coordinate, I think through Samaritan's Purse is there as well. and they're signing people up on shifts to come in and help shovel and clear trees and do such like that. I know they're looking for heavy equipment for land movers so that they can try and clear some of these roads to at least make them passable up and down the mountains to get medicine and supplies to people. So, you know, there's a lot of needs that they have, and there are some great people and companies coming to the rescue out there. Like, I don't know if you heard earlier, there was a man with a mule train, a train of mules loaded up at, as far as his video camera would show. And, you know, it's really incredible the ingenuity of Americans to get help to other Americans in need. It's been incredible to witness that this week.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to watch that keyword, ingenuity, the ideas people have and what it takes to get from the Cajun Navy to the horses. I've been impressed, and not because this is some sort of centrally controlled, highly organized effort,
right,
at an agency level or even an organizational level, with maybe Samaritan's Purse being a bit of an exception. It's just because community.
Yeah.
They come together, they rally around their local church or city hall, whatever it may be, and say, okay, bring donations here. We're the people you can trust. Everything's going to go to people. And unfortunately, if everything I'm reading is true, the biggest hindrance besides the actual damage caused by the hurricane is government agencies trying to control everything in the wrong way.
Well, and it's so crazy because I actually remember the conversations when they were reallocating FEMA funds 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when they were discussing the reallocation of those funds, and everyone's saying, like, what if there's a major hurricane? What if we need that money to help Americans in a hurricane? And it was kind of brushed off. And I think we've been okay for the last couple of years, and it hasn't been really noticeable. But all of a sudden now it's September or October now, and we're out of money for hurricane season, and we have people still trapped in their houses a week later. So while it didn't have like an absolute public immediate effect in the reallocation, it does have an effect now that's clearly visible to anyone who's listening or paying attention outside of mainstream media.
Yeah, no way to hide in that.
Right.
Illegal aliens filling our nicest hotels and our people getting nothing.
Yeah. I saw something this week, and it was talking about the Roosevelt Hotel in New York City. And they were saying, you should get the migrants out and reopen it to the public. We'd love to stay there. And they said, well, on second thought, they've really ruined that hotel. So we have all of these hotels that have become migrant hostels, and the government's renting them out wholesale, not letting Americans stay there. And they're destroying these properties. What are they going to even do when Trump is reelected in November? You like the when there? When Trump is reelected in November and mass deportations happen in January, and all of these hotels have to rebuild or recover what's been done to them for years. How do they even go about doing that? I don't think we even understand the depth of how much there is to fix or recover once we remove the bad administration.
It's going to be significant. And all I can say is kind of a final word is I didn't vote for that.
Same. Neither did I. I actually don't think a lot of people voted for that, but they call me a conspiracy theorist if I talk about election fraud, so I won't do that.
That just makes you a fact-based journalist.
Ah, well, it is what it is these days. We'll have enough evidence to prove it. In the public soon enough, I'm sure. I appreciate that this election will have far more eyes on it than any election in our previous history. So it should be an interesting month or so here.
Yes, it should. And so, Darren, thanks again for joining us here today on the Conservative Voice once more. We're looking forward to having you with us at a Keystone Town Hall on October 24. And again, then, on the Conservative Voice the next day. So we look forward to having you join us in person next time.
Yeah, absolutely. 12 days before the election. I mean, what could go wrong?
That's right. It'll be great. All right.
Good talking to you.
Thanks very much.
You too. Thank you.
And now we will we'll turn our attentions once more to the situation with migration, right? It's just incredible what we're seeing. The the city that we, of course, all started hearing about was Springfield, Ohio. And then quickly thereafter, this story of this town called Charleroi started popping up. We all started to ask questions. Well, where is Charleroi? Turns out I've probably driven through it, didn't know. And it's a small town in western Pennsylvania that's had the same problems as the town of Springfield. And so we thought we'd find someone who could come on and help us understand what is going on there. And joining us now is Sean Logue. Sean is the chairman of the Washington County Republican Committee in southwest Pennsylvania. And so, Sean, welcome to the Conservative Voice.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Really glad to have you here. I saw a segment in a YouTube video. It looks like a citizen journalist came out to your area and you spoke to him. Can you give us some information on what that was about and what you guys were talking about so everyone else can hear?
Hey, before I do that, can I make a quick comment about the hurricane and your prior conversation?
Absolutely. Sure.
You know, what are the odds that 45 days before the most important election since Lincoln, that a massive once-in-a-lifetime hurricane comes through and hits two swing states, Georgia and North Carolina? And what I find really strange about the whole thing is that it wasn't the coast of North Carolina that got hit, but it was the rural mountainous parts. How often do hurricanes survive on land to get to the rural mountainous parts? And of course, these places are totally devastated. And then, if you had watched Jesse Waters the other night, Jesse Waters talked extensively about how the federal government is preventing people from getting into the region and helping people out. And of course, FEMA has enough money to take care of all kinds of illegals and migrants. However, they have no money for hurricane relief.
Yeah.
You know, forgive me for being a conspiracy theorist, but there's something up. And you know, in the 1970s, the United States used weather weapons against Vietnam. This is a fact. It's called Operation Popeye. This is not fiction. They used weather weapons to take out the Ho Chi Minh Trail so that the North Vietnamese could not supply the Viet Cong in South Vietnam. So my point is I have no evidence of anything, but I find this to be a terrible coincidence that all these factors hit all one after another. So
let me just touch on one thing you said. So the weather as a weapon thing, it was 1969 to 1972. It was in Cambodia that the United States was able to increase rainfall over the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which made it much more difficult for personnel and materiel to move down the trail. And, you know, that was, of course, helpful to the American troops and the South Vietnamese troops that were not happy to see that weaponry and those additional reinforcements coming down the trail. But that's just where it, where weather was used for the first time as a weapon. Now, recently, if you saw some of the floods that occurred in the Middle East, there were camels swimming through the desert in floodwaters just a month ago, or maybe it was more than a month. It could have been 2-3 months ago. And what we found out is that there are sophisticated weather modification tools that have been put in place in Dubai and in Saudi, and they are doing that to try to bring more rainfall in and green the deserts, if you will.
And how did we find that out? We found it out because they said, oops, we overseeded. My bad.
Right,
oops.
Right. They went too far. They caused too much rain and everything flooded.
And Sean, I'm going to take your conspiracy theorist label away from you. I'm really sorry. I don't mean to do it. I do it in kindness and love. There's nothing conspiratorial or theory related to weather modification. You can actually look up Code of Federal Regulations. I'll be sure to tweet out this information. Title 15 specifically discusses maintaining records and submitting reports on weather modification activities. NOAA has a reporting website where you can go on and you can report your either cloud seeding or whatever weather modification methods that you're currently using. And then there are patents. They're longstanding patents. They've been out there. They are publicly available. Everyone can read them themselves to look into what our government has done or does currently do in regards to weather modification. And I mean, those patents go back to 1962 all the way up to 2020. I have a few of them. I'll be sure to share that on our Twitter. But there's nothing, you're not theorizing anything insane. They publish it themselves. They openly admit it. all they do is when someone else points it out, they've trained others to look at them as a quote unquote conspiracy theorist and call them liars and not believe them. It's truly insane how much truth is hidden under the conspiracy theory label.
There are also international conventions against the use of weather as a weapon. The Russians have it. The European Union has this.
Yep.
China, Japan, all these countries have this ability. Again, I don't remember any hurricanes that could get through the Appalachian Mountains and survive being on land that long. But again, I'm not a scientist. I don't know.
I will say the storm moved very quick. So, you know, it does make sense that it maintained some of its moisture and wind strength in the path that it took. I think that we're going to be talking about this storm for a very long time to come, and it's going to change the fabric of the lives for those who live in those mountain regions. They have to reconsider how they live. I know for us, when we look at properties to purchase, one of the big things are running water on the property, right? You want to survive any kind of eventuality. And now I'm second guessing that one. You know, maybe water nearby would be good enough. So it's certainly something to think about these days.
Well, and, you know, we were talking about Lahaina earlier as well, and there were a lot of folks that pointed out very, very strange circumstances around that, you know, where there would be two houses that burned and between them trees that did not.
Right.
And whatever.
Nothing blue burnt.
The blue roof thing. I mean, there were all these stories that came out, and as those stories mounted, the government made it worse by putting a black, web around the city so no one could see what was happening, and that just fueled all of the concerns that there was something strange going on. So we didn't explore much of that weather issue in the first hour of the show, but certainly the government's response we explored and how terrible it is and how Homeland doesn't have the money it needs to fund FEMA to go out and address something like the problem in North Carolina because they've spent it all at the Roosevelt Hotel and at other places where there are significant concentrations.
Or in Charleroi.
Of migrants, right. And one of those places is Charleroi. And so what is the real story on the ground in Charleroi?
Okay, so I'm going to give you the truth. The truth is a mixed bag. So we'll say like 5 years ago, out of nowhere, 2,000 Haitians showed up in a town of 4,000 people. Charleroi used to be a very special place. Its nickname was actually Shoe Leroy because at one point in time they had more shoe stores per capita than anywhere else in the United States. Charleroi is a small mill town that is on the Monongahela River.
Mm-hmm.
The people there are very like tough, hardy people, mostly of Italian and Slovak descent. Okay. And these people, they grew up around the mill, and the mills paid very well.
Yes.
The mills, however, began to fail in the 80s, and so now the town became depressed. About 5 years ago, out of nowhere, about 2,000 Haitians show up, Haitians and Liberians mostly, I'm sorry. We don't know where they came from. The best we can guess is that an NGO financed by the federal government acquired the interests of these people, and then a local employer teamed up with them to bring them up to do work. And again, they just showed up out of nowhere. As far as what these people are like to live with, they actually have a decent reputation. They work hard. So there are vans that pick them up early in the morning. They work all day at a factory that's in town, and then the van drops them off in the evening. The problem is that, they're a totally different culture and they do not mix with the native population.
Mm-hmm.
And they speak different languages. Okay. They have different customs. They are not committing crimes disproportionate to the native populations. We had briefings from the police chief about that. So that's not happening. They're not eating cats or dogs or anything like that. They seem to be behaving themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The problems are, is that they will load up in a house. So you'll get like 15 people in a house.
Yeah.
Okay. They've driven up housing costs through the roof of this lower middle class, town.
Oh, wait. I thought CBS said that wasn't why the housing crisis was happening. It had nothing to do with the migrants. Continue.
Never heard of the idea of increasing demand by like 2,000%.
Right.
Of unlimited supply. That wouldn't affect the pricing of the houses, right?
Right. No, yeah. Letting millions of people in and not knowing where they're going to live and then wondering why housing supply is short is definitely, there's no clear answers right in front of your face or anything. It's not obvious at all.
What's happened is that the Haitians aren't buying the houses.
Right.
That there are investors who are buying the houses. Now these are houses that are $30,000 houses, $50,000 houses that the native populations have, okay, and that have lived in for generations. They're all selling out. Investors are buying these houses and then renting them out to the Haitians.
Right.
The Haitians will put like 10 to 15 people in the house to afford the rent.
Right.
The rent is three.
What I was hearing is there's like employment contracts and they'll move them around. I was hearing that in regards to Ohio, that they're working for almost temp agencies who are helping them find the housing and moving them to different jobs. Is that what you're seeing?
So there is a factory in Charleroi.
Okay.
They work there for like $9 an hour.
Mm.
They get federal stipends.
Right.
So they have EBT cards that the federal government puts money on for them.
Mm-hmm.
They will try to get better employment somewhere else. And we have a massive like Walmart shopping plaza. Walmart actually pays well.
Yep.
So if they can figure a way to get into Walmart, they do very well. But the $9 an hour plus the federal stipend actually is a pretty nice lifestyle. And I said this on one of my interviews. Especially coming from Haiti, where, the leader of Haiti, his nickname is Barbecue.
Right.
That's not for a very good reason.
Yeah.
So the point is that this is a significant upgrade in their lifestyle. They fill up the churches, and the local people actually kind of like that. So the Haitians, they get dressed up, and they go to church. And the people who are still in Charleroi, you know, they're the descendants of Italians and Slovaks. You know, they remember when their grandparents used to take them to church. So they respect the Haitians for that reason. Where the big problem lies, again, is that they don't intermix. They stick to their own. They speak a totally different language. If you still live anywhere near them, it feels like you're living in the third world. You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't want to say a pack of men. But like they'll walk around together, speak very loud in their language, and you feel like you're an outsider. There are sections of town where they only shop and their stores have popped up, and there aren't like there's the idea that they're revitalizing the town. That's not true. They've only opened up about they've gone about 8 vacant storefronts. They haven't like opened up a whole bunch of businesses, and not businesses that serve everybody.
Right.
The businesses only serve themselves. Again, they're not committing disproportionate crime. However, auto accidents are a major problem.
Yeah, I'm hearing that everywhere with
that's also
the
true
Haitian
in Springfield.
Community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Charleroi is only like 2 miles long, and there's only like 2 major streets. 2 miles long one way, 2 miles long the other way, and like that's it. There has been an epidemic of car accidents in Charleroi.
Yeah.
Like they will drive into houses. They'll hit parked cars. I mean, it's quite frankly ridiculous. When the police like pull them over, they'll find that they don't have any of the right paperwork for driving, and the police have to impound these vehicles until they're able to be legal to be on the road.
Hey, at least they're impounding them, because I know in other small towns they're just not doing that.
No, they're impounding them in Charleroi.
Good.
The borough has had to increase the police budget by $75,000. For them, that's a lot of money.
And where does that money come from?
Well, I'm going to tell you that, number one, it comes from the taxpayers, but number two, I'm going to tell you about the twin crisis going on in Charleroi. And this is an important part of the story. But again, the police budget was increased by $75,000. The conversation now is maybe we should put traffic signs in Creole that hopefully they will be able to read and will be able to drive normally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the biggest problem is that the federal government dumped these people in and don't care. They don't care that they haven't helped out financially the borough. They haven't helped out anybody. The borough, until last year, was broke, and we had to raise taxes. I was actually the attorney for the borough for a year. Mm-hmm. We had to raise taxes because we didn't have the money. Fortunately, we sold some a borough asset for a good price. So the borough financially is okay. It's sound right now.
But you had to sell an asset for that.
Right.
What did the borough have to sell?
The borough actually owns the most valuable water and sewage treatment system in Pennsylvania that is independent. So that is a unique feature, again, of Charleroi, because, again, when the city was booming and there was a lot of wealth in the city, the forefathers of the city were wise enough to start a water and sewage system that then eventually reached out and provides water for the entire Mon Valley region, we call it.
Mm-hmm.
The borough was broke until we sold off an asset. But when that money runs out, the borough is going to have financial problems. The real problem, though, is with the school district. The school district is a very small school district. They need to come up with $750,000 over a two-year period to hire English as second language teachers, to train current teachers, and to hire interpreters. They have no money. They don't have they are broke. They cannot raise taxes because this year the two largest employers in Charleroi have announced that they are closing up shop. Charleroi is home to a plant that makes the Jimmy Dean sausages for breakfast sandwiches.
Really?
And they are also home to cookingware called Pyrex. It's the highest quality glass cookingware, and don't be surprised if you go home at night and open up your cabinet and you have a glass from the Pyrex plant.
Oh, we do. I know I do.
Yeah, both
they're the
of those
best
are
cans, by the way, everyone. Pyrex is wonderful.
They are the best. Yes. Well, they're made in Charleroi, and that factory is now closing. So again, Charleroi cannot absorb any costs, and especially with their two factories that are shutting down. And again, the federal government doesn't care. They're not providing any money to the school district. They're not providing any money to the borough. And what you said earlier about how, you know, our native population are being treated as second class citizens. You're damn right that's happening in Charleroi. And nobody cares. We have a U.S. senator. His name is Bob Casey. He is the absolute most worthless U.S. senator, like, in all of Congress. The guy does absolutely nothing. I'd rather have Pocahontas as my senator than Bob Casey because they vote almost identically.
Right.
But at least she runs around and does stuff. Bob Casey doesn't do anything. And so he will not come to Charleroi. He will not say Charleroi's name out in public. He won't do anything. When the Pyrex plant announced that they were closing, the union reached out to the people who work there, actually members of the United States Steel, U.S. Steel workers, USW.
Okay.
They reached out to the national management. National management wouldn't help them out. The national union would not help the local union out. They reached out to the Republicans in Charleroi, who then reached out to me. We came up with a game plan, and we brought our U.S. Senate candidate, Dave McCormick, who I think is going to beat Casey in this upcoming election. But by bringing McCormick in, we shamed the U.S. senators in Pennsylvania to at least write letters and do something. And, again, I don't know how this is all going to play out, but at the end of the day, the Charleroi is suffering from a twin crisis that are they're totally different, but they're linked. And, again, that is that a town of 4,000 people had over 2,000 nations dumped on them. The federal government does not care. The people of Charleroi have to pay for the migrants, and their two largest employers are about to close.
Wow.
So what's going to happen? I don't know. We had a Republican meeting last night, and we think eventually Charleroi will be like a dead zone to Native American citizens.
So it'll become really just a place where people who have endless government support, like Haitian migrants, who will be able to live there. And the American citizens will what? I mean, they're going to have to leave?
They're going to leave the school districts. Yeah, because, you know, the kids, American kids are not being treated well. They're not getting slots in Head Start programs. They're not getting slots in preschool. The school district has to cater to these Haitians.
Wow.
The Haitians are you know, they're not committing crimes against the native-born kids, but the interactions are not good. These Haitians are very are rough, and the native-born kids, you know, are just not used to the culture that has now come in. So this is not smooth. This is not a good thing. I don't want to. I'm not bad mouthing the Haitians. I'm not telling you that they're criminals or they're behaving horribly. I'm just telling you that they are an alien population, and they are being treated better by our government than native-born Americans are. And this town is in crisis. The federal government, and most importantly, United States Senator Bob Casey, they don't care.
Sean, we're coming up towards the end of the program, and we have to cut it off there, but we're definitely going to bring you back again to talk about this more. There's definitely a lot to discuss. Thank you so much for joining us. Everyone else, thank you so much for listening today on The Conservative Voice on WWDB. Be sure to follow us on our social media channels at TC Voice WWDB on Twitter and TC Voice on Instagram. And I'm Ada Nestor and Gary Heasley, and we are signing off for the weekend.
Thanks.